husband now. It's Tish.
And more importantly, the cold face of dealing with the provider community as well. Firstly, let me apologize for the fact that neither my chairperson nor my vice chairperson are here. My chairperson got to the airport as they closed the flight and obviously wasn't able to get on another flight. And my deputy chairperson is in fact convening our EXCO meeting, and our EXCO meeting has been convened to finalize the Auditor General's sign-off on our audit this year, so please forgive both of them for not being here. The service of CETA, CETA number 23, comprises 180,000 companies who are our members across 37 different industries, collected under the very loose banner and the very loose collective of services and specifically non-financial services. So for example, some of the blue-collar industries in our sector would be hairdressing, beauty, funerals. Some of the white-collar industries might be regarded as the marketing cluster of industries, project management, which as we know is the number one scarce skill in the country, and also the labor brokers, and specifically the temporary employment sector in this country, who are a major, major factor in the dissemination of our learnership success, and particularly the fact that the service of CETA is the leading CETA in terms of apprenticeships in this country. We have 11,000 apprenticeships in industry at this moment in time in training. we've only been in the apprenticeship game for the last 3 years, so we're particularly proud of that fact. We were established, as per the presentation, so we were established alongside the original group of CETAs, to be honest, initially as a rubbish bin CETA. So, for example, you couldn't put hairdressing together with project management into, or generic project management, into any particular CETA, so they were all sort of thrown and lumped together into CETA number 23. And that was a huge benefit for us 10 years ago, so because we managed to find the generic similarities and compatibility, and so build our sector into a very, very strong sector based on the European principle of subsidiarity rather than proportional representation. And I do need to stress that at this very outset of our discussion, that our CETA is run on the principle of subsidiarity, and that is no industry, no matter how large or how small, has any greater weight or any louder voice or any more votes than any other industry in our sector. And I think that has been a large reason for the quality of the success and the rate of success in our sector over the last decade, in that the same level of delivery in all 37-odd industries has been able to be achieved because of the principle of subsidiarity rather than proportional representation. I'd like to move to the slide on the medium-term strategic framework, which is really the directive that we, in fact, live by in the service of CETA. And that is that we have been focusing, at least for the last 5 years under NSDS2, on issues of economic growth and transformation, on building economic and social infrastructure, on rural development strategy, which I just need to emphasize we're not necessarily 100% in favor of in terms of the current definition of what rural development means, and you might in questions want to test us on that. We've also had a Department of Higher Education and Training focus, previously Department of Labor. We're very focused on the health profile of the working population in South Africa, and I can give you more details in that regard. Crime and corruption, we're very comfortable with what we're doing in the area of crime and corruption, even though we're not SAC-CETA, but a lot of our member companies provide services to SAC-CETA members. Sustainable communities, doing a fortune of work in that regard. International cooperation, we benchmark everything we do on a global basis, and I'm happy to elaborate on that later. Resource management and improvement of public services and strengthening democracy in this country. I'm very proud to say that at this moment in time, the service of CETA, sir, has close to 2,500 people farmed into the local government infrastructure in this country through our member organizations. And we're very proud of the work that they're doing from a customer management perspective in those local government communities. So as far as our strategic plan and budget for 2010-11 is concerned, this planning is in fact linked to that medium-term strategic framework. And just to give you a very brief rundown of our objectives in that regard, so we intend in this current financial year, which is 2010-11, to look at spending close to R1 billion in our CESA, R1 billion, where less than 9.7% of that is in fact being budgeted for administration. And as you know, the target for CESA is 10%, and that's R93 million. We intend in the course of this financial year to have deployed 16.1% of our income into mandatory grants. And for us, mandatory grants are an extremely important vehicle in getting our workplaces to have complied as much as they've complied in the past, but also into the future. And we're very pleased, therefore, that in NFDS 3, whereas the original intention was to, in fact, completely reduce the mandatory grant, it has, in fact, been kept as is. Well, reduced by 10%, but with the pivotal grant, in fact, being kept as is. And we think that's a very wise decision, sir, because what we believe is that there has to be a carrot and a stick approach to the business community. To be honest, not that they've ever asked for that carrot, but in reality, it has been a good instrumental tool to get our business community to do as much as they've done in our sector for the last 10 years. And then obviously on discretionary spending, we intend in this financial year to spend R520 million of discretionary funding, roughly about 54.2% of our income. As far as the National Skills Development 2 strategy is concerned, and that's the blueprint we currently work under, that R520 million is broken up as per that green diagram up there, and I'm sure you're all aware of what the 2.8, 4.1, etc. means, but maybe I could just ask my Deputy CEO just to give us a definition of those categories so we can be very specific about what we in the services CETA are currently in this financial year, in fact, spending our discretionary funding on, so that there's no misunderstanding, Deb. If you just wanted to find 2.8.
Thank you, yeah, I've got it here. Just to say that in terms of NFDS 2 extension, as we see that they've been re-established in this current financial year, we did get a directive from the Minister of Higher Education guiding how we spend the discretionary funding. And the first was really looking at the scarce and critical skills. And the directive was there that seekers should spend a minimum of 50% of their discretionary funding. And as you can see from the block there, the green block, we've budgeted 53% of the discretionary spend, primarily to indicate a 2.8 that looks at employed workers, 4.1 that looks at unemployed workers, and then 4.2 that has been a challenge in terms of how do we get people that have a paper qualification or a qualification but no experience, and that's linked to internships and experiential learning.
Can you just quickly pop down to the next slide so we can be specific about that, what our target for this year is that we're currently measuring ourselves against?
Sure.
We're looking at 5,510 learners on target 2.8. We're looking at 4,075 learners on target 4.1 and 3,225 learners on target 4.2 as per that slide. And in fact, most of those targets, which cumulatively amount roughly to about 12,000 learnerships, 12 to 15,000 learnerships in the course of this year, on that collection of targets that we're currently set to be meeting by next year, Mr. Chair. Sorry, did you want to carry on?
The secondary focus, if I could use the term and excuse the pun, it also talks about the second economy, is about CETAs directing at least 10% of their discretionary funds in terms of helping the poor, the vulnerable, etc. And so indicator 2.5 speaks to the BEE component in our economy and the small company BEE companies. 3.2 speaks to the non-levy paying companies, the NGOs, the community-based organizations, etc. 4.3 speaks about encouraging young people into entrepreneurship through the new venture creation. And then finally, one of the other major challenges that we face in our country is that of adult learning and programs that seek to address and give people a foot in terms of literacy, numeracy, and communication, etc.
Let me just jump in here again. I want to give you again, Chair, just an idea of the values that we're talking about. So on BEE support, we're talking about 400 small firms being funded towards not just accreditation from a BEE perspective, but capacitation from a BEE perspective. And let me say specifically, Chair, that our original target was much higher than that. The problem was that the small to medium-sized firms themselves, in terms of the application for the benefits we provided, et cetera, et cetera. So we are continuously looking to increase the number of small businesses we help to overcome the obstacles of establishing their credentials in that regard, although, quite frankly, the most onerous credential, which is not being overcome in this country at this moment in time, is the enterprise development credential. The whole idea that we're not just looking for them to be rated, but specifically to have enterprise development benefits, and that certainly will be a focus of ours for the next 5 years. We're working with 100 cooperatives in terms of getting them registered, getting them classified, and getting them into the income sourcing stream, not just in the public sector, but also in the private sector, because we have our fingers in 37 different industries, but I'm only too happy to play that game, Chen. As far as adult learning is concerned, I read the statement in the press recently about the business level 1 certificate, which is in fact being developed in this country and is being applied liberally in a number of other sectors, and we're very proud of that. We originated that learnership, we gave life to that learnership, and we're very proud of the fact that the CETA community in general has embraced the notion that training ABET for the sake of training ABET, quite frankly, is wasted expenditure. And it wasn't popular for the first 5 years of our existence to say that. That was the politically incorrect thing to say. That training literacy and numeracy without a context is a waste of money. And yet we've managed to now convince the CETA community, and I'm pleased to say particularly my minister, who at the MERCETA conference lauded that particular learnership, that in fact that was the right way to go. To contextualize ABET, to bring it onto the NQF at NQF level 1 rather than prior to NQF level 1. And we're very comfortable that at this moment in time in our CETA we've put close to 5,000 people through that process, which is really a bridging process into the world of work and is a contextualization of ABET 2, 3, and 4. And we're comfortable that that's the way to go. As you can see, we play very actively in the non-profit organization space, the NGO and the CBO space and the cooperative space. And as you can see as well, we've done a lot of work in the last year as far as new venture creation is concerned. Although, to be honest, we think that the new venture creation philosophy of the CETA community in general is by far wasted expenditure. And so our results, our research tells us that what is now contained in the draft NSDS3 proposal is a much better way to go, where in fact they're saying NSDS3, it's not just the youth you should change, Chase, but it's also the older people you should change. The word escapes me, that's in NSDS3, but essentially talking about people over the age of 50 who in fact are being retrained, who are losing their jobs just as they're becoming productive in working society. We think that's now the right way to go, Chen. And we'll spend a lot more money on new venture creation now that we're allowed to spend it on the right target market. We do not believe, generally, and I'm generalizing, but we do not believe that new venture creation expenditure on the youth is wise expenditure in this country, given how limited our resources are. We think it's far more important to send the youth to work than to give them scarce national resources to start their own businesses with no work experience whatsoever. We think that that element of the national resources should be thrown into those people who have experienced a cash crisis, who have been retrenched, who have lost their jobs, who have had the bank manager saying no, etc., etc., etc. And so we're very comfortable now that NSDS3 caters to that particular objective in terms of what we're trying to say. That's not to say that there aren't young people who are creating multi-million rand businesses as young people. But we think they're by far the exception, and we think it's a national excuse to encourage the youth to start their own businesses instead of finding jobs. And I know that's politically incorrect for me to say, Chair, but it certainly is our experience over the last 10 years. Good, thank you. Kevin.
Thank you, Chair. And then just in terms of the other projects where we look at the other 36% of our discretionary spend, we're quite proud that as a CETA we have 10 offices in South Africa and one in every province with two in the Eastern Cape. In terms of STF and career guidance, there's some new approaches to career guidance there. There's also a concept of mainstreaming career guidance into every single school. in South Africa using TV and newspaper as a medium. SME support to 6,550 enterprises, 48 million. ISOEs, Institutes of Sectoral Occupational Excellence, a provincial model there. NVC, New Venture Creation, these are the training providers. NQF support, strengthening the NQF, the QCTO, structures like that, etc. And then board governance and capacity building, constituency capacity building of organized business and organized labor constituents will form the balance of the discretionary projects. I don't know if you have to that.
Chair, no. Obviously, I'm very comfortable answering questions, particularly on our career guidance activities, because that seems to be one of the major focuses now of NSDS 3. And just to tell you briefly what we're doing in terms of career guidance this year, we are funding a project through the South African Qualifications Authority to establish, they've already established a call centre for career guidance purposes for schools, universities, school teachers and guidance teachers. If there were guidance teachers around, and that's obviously a bone of contention that I'm sure you share. But in addition to that, we've taken the 40 industries we're responsible for and established career guidance activities on television, and more importantly, creating DVD toolkits for the 25,000 schools in this country, and encouraging then those teachers who are working with those learners to in fact do it around the 40 industries we represent, as well as what the other seekers in fact have to present. Chair, I'm not going to take you through the actual target slides, which are slides 11 and 12, safe to say that those are the targets we, on an ongoing basis, measure ourselves against, and in fact report to the Department of Higher Education and Training on a quarterly basis against. I would like to take you into the previous financial year that we're now being audited against, just on some of those issues and accomplishments, and to take you to this slide, Chair, which basically shows you that we kept within 9.98% of our admin budget in the last financial year. We spent 98.1% of our mandatory grant, and in fact we spent 561 million rand on our discretionary expenditure. As far as the performance highlights are concerned, well, you'll see that those are just numbers we're really talking about, and you know, we don't want to belabor the point that these hopefully are acceptable numbers to this committee in terms of the penetration we're able to actually make out there. Chair, I want to take to the next slide because I know that is obviously a very contentious issue at this moment in time. If you read NSDS 3, National Skills Development Strategy 3, it appears from the reading of that document that CETAs have been sleeping for the last 10 years and consciously not wanting to work with public institutions. Now that's a complete lie. It's not just a misdirection, it's not just a misreporting. It's a complete misrepresentation of the truth, Chair, and I do need to bring that to your attention. As far as our theatre is concerned, we work with 20 public further education training colleges. They offer hairdressing training, they offer beauty training, they offer some of our management and our marketing courses as well. We work with a number of universities, public universities in the country as well, Chair. So the reading of NSDS 3, as far as the public training providers being the victim in this game, is a complete misrepresentation of the truth of what's happened in the last 10 years. If you read that NSDS 3 document, it appears that CETAs have somehow done things to disadvantage public training providers, and that's exactly the opposite of what's actually happened in this country. And that's why we attach this list to you, and this is just a sample list, Chair, just to indicate just how intensive our relationship with some public training providers, in fact, are. The reality is, however, over the last 10 years, it's been very difficult to break into public training providers, either at the further education or at the higher education level, to get them to want to do business with our feet. And we continuously bat at the door, knock at the door, and try and do those programs. And we've run a number of very successful programs with a number of very successful FET and HET institutions in the past, Chair. We were asked, by the way, in a separate email from your committee, for a list of all of the training providers we deal with that has been submitted. I'm not sure that all of the information, however, has been submitted to you in terms of how much we've actually spent with them as far as their BE credentials are concerned. But let me just talk for a minute, while we're talking about providers, let me talk about the credential issue, the BE credential issue. Our sector has a transformation committee, which is representative of those 37 industries. And that transformation committee implemented the strategy in the services sector that says from this year onwards, we are implementing, and we're now doing it, the enterprise development means test for any training provider appearing on any of our contracts. And what that means is that if they're a training provider of a medium size, irrespective of race or color or pedigree, if they're a training provider of medium size, we expect them on current contracts to evidence to SME, and I need to emphasize black SME beneficiaries as training providers in the current contract, who will by the end of the contract in fact become accredited for the same learning programs that the beneficiary is currently benefiting from in terms of the contract. Because we're doing that to build up a database of providers into our industry, given what's happened over the last 10 years. Now, we insist that those providers become accredited by the end of the contract, and in fact we withhold the component of the contract fee for that specific purpose, Chair. Because our intention has always been, and continues to be, to promote those training providers on a preferential basis to our member organizations around the country. And I know there have been certain comments as well in the media about issues of preferential procurement, tenderpreneurship, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm very comfortable in taking any questions in that regard as far as the activities of in fact, the services feature is concerned. Chair, we were asked to do a SWOT analysis of strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, and that document is, in fact, contained in front of you. And rather than focus on the strengths and opportunities, I want to focus on the weaknesses and the threats. We are saying that if you look proportionally at the fact that the services sector services 180,000 companies in all 9 provinces around the country, close to 2.5 million employees we service and collect levies on behalf of, remembering that the TES and the atypical employers are a large component of our levy contributors, Chair. We are saying that from a weakness perspective, we have a relatively small team to service that constituency, and that's a service industry problem. It's not just a services seekers problem. It's a milieu which all services organizations find themselves in, both private and public sector in this country. Our technology platforms are not what they should be, Chair, our online platforms, and I'm certainly not here blaming broadband. I'm not one of those people who always blame things on the fact that we don't have speed of broadband. I think the problem, Chair, is that very often the development for platforms are the problem, and I think very often the quality of development in this country is not always what it should be cracked up to be. And certainly, we're not one of those seekers. We took a strategic decision 10 years ago that we wouldn't sell out to one of the big 5 auditing firms in terms of running our CETA. We made that strategic decision, Chair. And yes, we've paid the price in terms of not necessarily having the economy of scale, but I think it serves us in good stead. Some of our regions are in development rather than fully developed. That is a weakness in our sector. But there again, Chair, excuse me, we were given the directive initially that we shouldn't, and I'm saying here in our relationship with our principal, Department of Labor, that we shouldn't focus on establishing a regional office in a region where we had less than 20% of our membership. If we kept to that directive, Chair, we would now only have 3 regional offices. So we broke our own rule in that regard, and we've established regional offices in every province around the country, some provinces where we have very limited membership, for example, the Northern Cape, et cetera, et cetera, because we think the presence will build eventually. If you build it, they will come. So, yes, some regions are underdeveloped, but it's a continuous strategic objective and intent of our organization. Customer satisfaction, we benchmark ourselves not against the public sector, but the private sector, and from a customer satisfaction point of view, we're lucky if we have a 60% rating, and we know that because we test it. And 60% is not good enough compared to the corporate sector. Public sector, we know our rating is higher, but we don't benchmark ourselves in the public sector, Chair. Because we service the private sector, to be honest. We don't have any public sector components of our CETA. So we're continuously struggling with the issue of customer satisfaction. And our retention strategy as far as staff retention is concerned is good, but it's always a threat, given that there are now 6 new CETAs and there's limited skills base around, et cetera, Chair. So we're always continuously working at that one. Threats, headhunting of key personnel, it's obviously always an ongoing threat. Territorial disputes on cross-sectoral areas, particularly given that we're the marketing sector, we're the business admin sector, we're the business consulting sector, which is very much cross-cutting, but we manage that on a case-by-case basis. And obviously there's a lot of overlap as well on the artisan issue, which I think is just because it's early days of the service CETA being in the artisan arena. So there's a lot of overlap with other CETAs also offering artisan qualifications, the accreditation of trade training centers and trade testing centers. But we're seeing a lot of goodwill from the Department of Higher Education and Training to work with us in overcoming that particular problem. So, Chair, I don't want to belabor the weaknesses and the threats, but just to say we're aware of them, and we are, in fact, working on them on an ongoing basis. Chair, if you want, I'm very comfortable about going over our medium-term strategic alignment. There are many, many issues and many, many points, and it certainly is contained in the document. However, you know, I'm aware that there could be a lot of questions for us, and it might be more opportune to deal with sort of the question and answer activity rather than simply going through all of our accomplishments and our various projects. We were asked to report on them. We did. But
we'll be able to just glance through that.
And we can come back to it if we have questions in that regard, Chair. Chair, I just wanted to talk about what's on page 14 of my handout, which is slide 28, which is our fight against crime and corruption. This is a very specific project which we've picked up on in the service of CETA. Over the last 5 years, we've put close to about 800 people into police stations around the country on customer management and business administrative learnerships from the service of CETA, so that, and this is a project which is done in partnership with independent newspapers, particularly Mr. Muhsin Williams at Independent Newspapers, absolutely fantastic editor, sir, who has in fact worked with the service of CETA in putting these people into police stations around the country nationally, so that the policemen themselves and women can be then freed up to carry out police duties. We're about to release another 400 people into those communities. And the beauty about that, Chair, is that there's a large percentage of retention of those individuals when they finish those learnerships on an admin basis in those offices as well. So we're very proud of that issue in terms of crime and corruption. And obviously there are many, many, but that's just what we're doing in one area that I did want to highlight to you. Good. Chair, maybe, you know, just to not belabor many of these points, and I mean, I'm very aware of the fact that we were asked to report on what we've done, and what we've done seems like a lot of bragging and boasting, and it's not. It's just factual, and I don't want to belabor that point. I want to rather get into some of the contentious issues, and maybe I can then turn to slide 35, finally, before we take questions and interaction, Chair, and look at our youth unemployment strategy. That we're doing things about in the service of CETA. First of all, Chair, what we're doing is we're looking at the quality of work which is available from our 180,000 companies across 37 industries in terms of a decent work program. And in fact, what we've done, and we've done this in association with the International Labour Organization, is we've introduced a decent work grading mechanism for our member companies, small, medium, and large, where in fact we're grading those businesses in terms of whether they're decent employers, in terms of the ILO four legs of what decent work means, and in fact we're putting them either on, you know, recognizing that they're decent work as a level, or in fact we're putting them on a developmental band where we're obviously implementing interventions around the country to bring them up to that level where we say, where we can say they're decent work employers, because those then become the employers of choice, of preference, for many of our programs and for many of the entrants of new work seekers into the world of work. Chair, I've spoken about our career guidance projects, which are working well. Our apprenticeship program, we currently have close to 12,000 people in apprenticeships, three-year apprenticeships, or the trade testing element of the apprenticeship in the system. We've got lots of learnerships for youth. We've got close to 75 different learnership categories, which we've implemented across those 37 industries. Internships as well, Chair, which are proving very, very effective. And we have a huge bursary program and a huge new venture creation program. But, Chair, I'm going to say this. Our new venture creation program changes as of now because we believe that there is a huge amount of wasted expenditure on new venture creation in this country, and we've experienced it in our CETA. I mean, over the last 10 years, we've funded close to 6,000 people on new venture creation training. And the problem is that we've very often been the only supply-side funding initiative for those guys. And the problem then is you're training for unemployment. You're training for a person to establish their new business who, when they knock on the door of DTI, have no access to funding and have no security for access to funding, and that's a perennial problem. And we're now shifting our NVC focus to say we're not providing NVC funding.
unless there is a guarantee of capital startup for that business as well, to make sure that the only people we're training are people who are going to establish their own businesses, rather than to be simply trained to establish their own businesses without any hope of doing so. We did a project together with the Danish Hairdressing Trade Union a year ago, where we put the developmental funding in. The Danish Hairdressing Trade Union put the capital funding into 30 businesses, specifically Afro hairdressing businesses, around the country, and a number, six of those, in fact, here in the Western Cape, to prove that the model works, to actually prove that if you've got developmental capital and training capital, and you do it together at the same time on the same project with sufficient coaching, that it can work, and those businesses are sustainable, and those business people are making a lot of money in the process of being sustainable. So we've proven the model can work, and yet, unfortunately, there is disjuncture between the access of developmental capital, which we are, as opposed to the access of capital investment and intensive capital investment. And I know this isn't the DTI portfolio, the Trade and Industries portfolio, but especially in the area of new venture creation, there is an absolute synergy, Chair, that we're begging for. Chair, we're very proud of the fact that together with the National Youth Development Agency, we are working on 3,000 second chance projects, where in fact we're providing bursaries for 3,000 young people who failed matric or not got a sufficiently decent matric pass to go back to school and in fact to redo that matric. We're hoping from an occupational context, not from a purely educational context, because the educational context doesn't work. We know that doesn't work. We can prove that doesn't work. So we're hoping from an occupational context. And we have 3,000 of those bursaries in the market for young people out there at this moment in time. We also have, Chair, and I know this is a bone of contention, specifically with some of the directors in the Department of Education proper, but we also have close to 3,500 individuals on our school feeder project. And what that means is we've introduced our occupational qualifications into grade 10 in the school. We've taken a one-year occupational qualification, split it up into 3 years, be it marketing, be it public relations, be it project management, be it events management, and we've introduced those as extramural subjects into the schooling system, Chair, so that by the time an individual matriculates, they will have obtained a qualification in addition to matric, obtained a qualification by matric, which is an occupational qualification, the same qualification that someone leaving matric would then look to get into the world of work, and more importantly, 3 years' worth of work experience as well, Chair, because we put them into our 180,000 companies across the country. That project is proving very successful, the most recent component of it being a paralegal qualification, where we're introducing from grade 10 a paralegal qualification on an extramural basis. Why? To be very honest, Chair, so that by the time the person matriculates, they will have been introduced to my property management companies, my real estate companies, who use conveyances on an ongoing basis, so that they don't necessarily need to go to university to get a degree before they get into the world of work. Plus, they will have worked for those companies for 3 years, after hours, weekends, on holidays, etc., not job shadowing, actually doing the work based on the outcomes of their qualification. So that the person matriculating comes out with a good matric, a better matric, I must say, an occupational qualification, and 3 years' worth of work experience in a CV and a full portfolio of evidence. And that's making them competitive, Chair. We're very proud of that project. It's not necessarily popular, particularly amongst the educationalists who believe that people should only begin to start focusing on work when they finish school. We think that's absolutely ridiculous. And in fact, we face those educationalists head on who tell us that. You're putting too much burden, too much pressure on these young people. And it's not the case, Chair. They have huge capacity for additional absorption of stress and pressure. And it's proving so. The beauty about that particular project is not in the private schools. It's in the public schools and it's in the rural areas, not in the urban areas. That's the beauty about that kind of project. So we're very proud of that, Chair. It's costing us more than obviously our normal bursary would, but it's well worth it as an investment. And it's not a philanthropic gesture. The gesture is very simple and selfish. It is to say that we're creating a better qualified labor pool for our industries, 37 industries, so that by the time people leave matric, they are ready for the world of work. And they're not going to make the mistake of taking another 3 years to find the path they want to follow. So we're very proud of that project, Chair. And we would love for this committee to actually attend some of those launches and some of those periodic reviews with us to test the schools and test the teachers and test the communities to, in fact, see if those projects are working. because we think there are huge lessons to be learned in that regard. So, Chair, maybe we can sort of revert to questions and answers now rather than me belaboring the point.
Yes, thank you. I would want us to then deal with this. Just the one thing that you should possibly later respond to. Any issues around the NSDS3 that, for example, apart from the positive stuff that you've identified, because you've identified some of that already, is there any issues that you believe as the service receiver also needs to be reflected on? That doesn't mean there is still a process that we will roll out at the public hearing level. So it's not that process yet, but any kind of critical issues that we need to be aware of so that we can factor some of those issues in. Then, just the issue around, I think that's very last one that you just raised, and I'm going to allow members to speak. The question around this grade 10 to grade 12. Last week, there was the YCL summit, and one of the inputs that I've picked up from, I think, is it Minister Ibrahim Patel then, related to the fact about the unemployed young people and the fact that they don't have experience then. And therefore, they knock on the door of business, and the answer is we need experience. Most of our people know that reality. So you've got graduates with BCOMs, but they don't have experience. Would this be, this idea about between grade 10 and grade 12, would that be helping to prepare them much faster for that work environment, one? Two, what would be the objective, not from where services CETA would be sitting, but what would be the objective reason why, as you said, it seems to me the basic education department official would not want to venture in, or some of them, into this and rolling it out, because some of the things that we were looking at was between grade 10 and grade 12, how do we in fact look at much more schools for skills? And I know the basic education portfolio is also biased, and there's three members sitting here, but I do know something the chairperson raised also with me, that the link between those school of skills and where innocent grade 10 to grade 12 are getting much more practical occupational orientation. So it's a bit of an anomaly hearing what you are saying, that here there's an initiative that you, and then I'm picking up twice or thrice the fact that you are saying some in the department would not necessarily want to mention that. Can you just clarify that point? And then I would want to immediately hand over to members, and we'll not allow five, but we'll allow two people, and then we'll get responses. Just on that.
Thank you, Chair. As far as the National Skills Development 3 strategy is concerned, there are just four issues I wish to bring to your attention. The first is that our minister has published very widely on wanting to see recognition of prior learning as an institutional vehicle in this country. And we laud that. I mean, we've been working with RPL as an opportunity now for the last 5 years in our CETA. We've put 15,000 people through the RPL process very, very successfully across a range of qualifications in our CETA. My concern about NSDS3 is if the minister is serious about RPL, and if he's serious about saying that every institution, public and private, must have RPL as one of its mechanisms, in other words, you come to me as an institution, but you've been in the job for 20 years, I should not have to ask you to go through 3 years of training before giving you a qualification. I should test your level of competence. So I laud the minister for raising the point, but then why does he publish a draft bill or a draft piece of regulation that says institutions only have to implement by 2016? Why has he given particularly public institutions in this country the leeway, the option, not to apply recognition of prior learning until 2016? In other words, the expiration of this NSDS3. Why is that? That's like an abomination of the principle of RPL. It's like saying that UCT can continue to insist that no matter how experienced you are, you've got to sit in my classroom for 3 years before you get the qualification, and they're allowed to do it until 2016, and only then will we force them to implement RPL. That's, to be honest, Chair, that's an aberration. It's an abomination, given that every public institution in this country has had RPL regulations and legislation on the table for the last 10 years. But they just do not apply RPL properly because they don't want to apply RPL because it affects their bottom line in terms of income, Chair. And I think that's a critically important point from our perspective. You can't operate like that. It's about the dignity of people in this country, and it's about saying, well, your dignity only becomes important in 2016. So that's the first point. And sorry, Chair, I'm just responding based on a roadshow we're currently running. Chair, I'm also just going to highlight to you the point that this draft NSDS 3 is absolutely anti-private training providers. No matter what the apologists say and the fact that it's not that anti, it's absolutely anti-private training providers, and it's directing CETAs to focus the vast majority of our expenditure towards public training providers. And I need to say this, Chair, the door has been open for 10 years. We've implored public training providers, those that have walked through the door we do business with. But we do business with 8,000 private, mostly SME training providers out there who have sweated blood for the last 10 years to become accredited, spent hundreds of thousands of rands to get their learning programs accredited, and are given no recognition whatsoever in NSDS 3. In fact, they are told that they're told specifically in NSDS 3, their role is to capacitate the public training provider, to literally hand over their strategic advantage to the public training provider, and then what? To walk away from the public training provider and the provision opportunities. It's absolutely unconstitutional, Chair, and that's certainly an observation. Disability, Chair, is the third point, and I've only got 4 points in terms of NSDS 3. Disability. In NSDS 1 and NSDS 2, they were specific. They said spend a minimum of 4% of your money on the disabled community. We're very comfortable. In the last year, we spent 22% of our money on the disabled community. Learnerships, bursaries, internships, opportunities, etc., etc. They've now taken that 4% out altogether. And that says it's important to spend money on disability, but no targets, no directives. So what's the message to the disabled community? You're important, but because CETAs collectively have spent less than 1% of their money on the disabled community, we've proven that you're not that receptive or you're not that successful, so we're going to walk away from our commitment to you as a community. And, Chair, we think that's a massive step backwards for people in the disabled community and especially the vulnerable group community. Very finally, we think it's peculiar that there is no emphasis in NSDS 3 on the actual agents of the National Skills Development Strategy in the workplace, specifically skills development facilitators. There's no mention of them. In the first NSDS 1, they were very prevalent. They were the agent of the workplace in the relationship with CETAs, and more importantly, 15% of discretionary fund of your mandatory grant should be paid to SDS. The 15% was then taken out of NSDS 2, but SDS were given additional functions and responsibilities. NSDS 3, absolutely silent. It's like they don't exist. So if we're not to use, as CETAs, registered skills development facilitators in our member companies, who are we to use as the go-between? The HR department is really not worth the paper they're written on generally in this country. Skills development facilitators understand this legislation and have spent 10 years implementing it and very often sweating blood to implement it. And now they're just wiped off the face of the earth in NSDS 3. So we've got no idea where they've gone. We'd like to help find them somewhere. Coming to your second question, Chair. School projects, grades 10 to 12. Well, we agree. The problem last year was hundreds of thousands of matriculants unemployed and unemployable. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to deal with that problem. We're trying to say that by the time you reach matric, you should have at least 3 years' worth of working experience in relevant companies, have tried a couple of things maybe. And I failed to say that a little earlier. 60% of the components of our learnerships are transportable between different industries. So at least try different things so that by the time you matriculate, you've got a fair idea of where you slot in the working world, and you've been exposed and sensitized to the world of work, and you've got a portfolio of evidence. The point you mentioned is it's a catch-22. I go for a job to get a job, and they say, if you can't show us experience, we can't give you your first job. This is intended to get around that problem, and we think it's going to be very successful in that regard. It's not the graduate placement program, though, however, and I haven't spoken about that, but we're implementing, together with the social partners in this country, a graduate placement program in all 9 provinces around the country. We're starting with 500 graduates per province, where in fact the intention is to put them onto our learnerships, and we're doing that already. We take a 3-year graduate, matric plus 3 graduate, we put them into an entry of 4-level learnership. Now, some graduates find that demeaning, Chair, but other graduates, especially those out of work, say, we understand why you're doing that. Put us on a 1-year learnership, and the fact that we've got a degree will help us to fast-track ourselves into the world of work. And so we're doing that with 500 in each province, in other words, 4,500-odd around the country, graduate placement program, Chair, but that's not our school project. Coming now to the Department of Basic Education and the Graduate Placement Program. So I had a meeting with the newly appointed Director General of the Department of Basic Education, and we pitched to him an opportunity to use our Graduate Placement Program to take graduates back into the school environment, unemployed graduates, back into the school environment as teacher assistants on our project management learnership. Why? Because we've looked at the generic project management learnership and we've seen that the various outcomes are very compatible with what goes on in the classroom, particularly in terms of outcomes-based education, which I personally think is the best thing this country could ever have done, by the way. And I know that's apolitical too, or you know, that's not the right thing to be saying. But I support outcomes-based education and the way it's been devised. Now, we've said to the schools, take these people into the classroom, because our experience with our school program is showing that on average in this country, the ratio is 1:40. One teacher to 40 learners. It is impossible to teach 40 learners properly with one person doing all the work, including all the administration, including all the syndicate group facilitation expected in terms of outcomes-based education, et cetera, et cetera. So we approached the department and we said, look, we'd like to use the opportunity to take unemployed graduates into our project management learnership, put them in the classroom for a year, let them be a teacher's assistant, so that suddenly you've got a ratio of 2:40 or even more, possibly. And the answer was no. The answer was this, and I'm quoting the current Director General of Basic Education. It's going to create the wrong expectation of assistance and help amongst the learners, and it's going to create a sense of complacency amongst the teachers, which is unsustainable. Now that, with respect, is an administrative view on this opportunity, Chair. It's a case of saying you're passing the headache of keeping the system sustainable onto me, and I don't want that headache. But even if it had only lasted for 1 year, and we put 1,000 people into project management learnerships in the classroom as teachers' assistants, what would the quality of this year's matriculants be like? So that's just in answer to your question, Chair. I have absolutely, I have to answer the rest of your question, because the rest of your question related to where we think the negativity from the education sector is coming towards our school program.
Can we, because you've gone into the details of that, I think you've mentioned some
upfront. Okay, fair enough, Chair.
Just in terms of enough time for other issues as
Yes, sir.
So what we're going to suggest is more direct responses then. I think it was interesting to hear the RPL issue because we've actually, if there's one issue that this portfolio committee believes also is around the RPL and the concerns, not necessarily, and what you've picked up here is our analysis is everyone speaks RPL but it's not really being implemented and we don't understand what is some of the blockages. But let's park that. I've noted Member Kuvai, and also just to indicate, thank you for coming back because the last few days she was literally having to look after a child that was not well. So thanks for being here. I've noted your hand.
Thanks for the report. Just first thing that I wanted to respond or to ask is around the targets and implement, just because there's nothing that reflects what is the employment equity within the services sector. Who's there, where are they in terms of just the structure? Just highlighting even the board, there's nothing that we have received here unless if maybe in my absence some documents were sent in and I didn't get. But it would be interesting to see who's the intent of it, if they can reflect that. The second issue, Chair, I want to speak on is also I would have loved to see in terms of the skills layoff, if there's been any targets that they've set and any expenditure that they've incurred during that process, how many people have been put on the skills layoff.
Sorry, could you just repeat that question?
Skills layoff.
Ah, thank you. Thank you for that one.
Yeah, just to get what has been targeted and what has been spent. What are the issues around this?
Good.
The specific skills layoff? And also on provincial allocation, I just scanned through the document. It doesn't specifically tell us where. Noting with other cities, we have difficulties in certain provinces in terms of just uptake of the skills development and all that, so that based on the decisions we've taken with the previous one, do we have the same problem with other provinces? Which are those, if you do have you been able to have skills development in all the areas, in all the provinces, and how much are you able to spend the money with those provinces? And then last two issues, Chair, it's the career guidance through which the CEO has reflected on. My feel on the issues that you spoke on, CEO, would not speak on your remote areas and your rural areas. If you talk about the call center, you talk about the DVDs, you talk about the TV sets. If you go to deep rural areas, those kids, those are the ones that normally don't have exposure to career guidance. The multi-classes, if you talk about basic education, they are faced with, especially farm schools, where it's one teacher teaching multi-grades and all those issues. And normally there are no career guidances there. And therefore the environment as well, it's not enough in terms of there are no TV exposure, there are no radio exposure, or even limited radio exposure. But what level are we trying to expose those kids in those remote areas and rural farms to career guidance that exists? And then lastly, Chair, my view, and I think there are two issues that the CEO highlighted around the removal of the 4% disabled and SDF. I think it's quite important for us to really note those and take them off. But lastly, Chair, the issue, speaking as a young person, the issue of resources, your new venture creation CEO, that you spoke to say it's rather not advisable to spend a lot of money on young people who want to create businesses, rather spend it on a older people who have been retrenched, who have skills. The reality of the situation is that if you're sitting with a youth country or a young country, you've got to find a way of securing the future of these young people for the country to have a better future. Secondly, is to say, if these young people come into the exposure of saying we want to do this businesses and therefore, and your feel is that the experience within the past years that they are not really successful because of lack of exposure and all those things, what are the things that we can put in place? Because I don't think that we should take the view of saying let's rather forget about this area or reduce the level of funding.
It's not throwing out the baby with the
water. Yeah, no, I'm just saying even reducing. I don't support the issue of reducing even the funding for that particular category. But I'm saying, what is the level of support that we need to put in place? Because the market can't be able to absorb all of them. If you're talking about those young people who are out there, we've got to be able to find a way of also splitting to say, those who are interested in business, let's provide the support, let's get them into the business sector. But there should be that way of support to be able to sustain, I mean, link them to other. Msobo, we used to have those voucher program systems at the past, you know, where they are given some trainings and all those things, which at times, yeah, was not to that level. But I'm saying we have identified the gap to say if it's there, let's try and close that gap, not to say let's reduce the funding. I would not support the issue of reducing the funding for that category. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. I'm going to allow the next person, and then we'll get to responses. So what we are going to do is members to be quite direct, and then also just a more direct response. I think the second person was Member Jane.
I had three direct questions. The first is the audit committee, because there are many opportunities for extreme difficulties in terms of financial management in the chain that you're dealing with, and the principal vehicle to monitor that would be an audit committee. So could you describe to me how that's done, and at which point in the chain you actually have very strict monitoring, and whether as part of your auditing, the auditing of your CETA, whether they actually have a look at, they examine the minutes of the audit committee, and whether that's open to public scrutiny. First question. The second question is that the Minister of Health, Dr. Mazzoledi, has turned towards the private sector to find high-level managers in the health arena, including directors of hospitals. And I'm at the medical school at the University of Cape Town, so I have some knowledge of what happens at Groteskier in terms of management requirements. And so what I would like to know from you is what level of management training you do, and whether you're happy with that. The third point is, I'll pose it as a question, if we were to force you to spend 80% of your money on FET colleges,
public.
Yes, on FET colleges.
Public colleges.
Yeah, public colleges, not private ones. Public ones. What would that mean in terms of the quality of the work that you do? See, the problem that we actually have in this country is that government funds the FET colleges. FET colleges are under-enrolled, and then CETA money goes somewhere else. Okay, it's not spent in a concentrated way at the FET college level.
Okay, thank you.
Responses on that, and possibly just shorten the responses.
Chair, I'm very pleased to say on equity that we've had a DOL favorable report for the last 10 years in terms of our employment equity statistics in the services CETA directly. Let me say, in the services CETA, that's the people I employ. As far as transformation in the sector is concerned, that's a completely different issue and certainly well worth debating. But that wasn't the question. Just to give you statistics, 90% female, 85% PDI. And when we talk about PDI, we're not talking about white females. We're talking about proper PDI. That's colored, black, and Indian individuals of both genders. underrepresented in the area of disability, I think we're only like at the moment 3% disability. Should be much higher, Chair. So we're obviously always on a learning curve in terms of transformation. Skills layoff. I need to say this about skills layoff. So when someone is retrenched, they tend to go to a temp agency and say, can you find me a job even on a temporary basis? So we see the results of the skills layoff directly in terms of an increase in levies when people become temps. Let me start off by saying that and answer your question. So we said to the minister, we are very happy to commit to high levels of targets for skills layoff. 6 applications to the CCMA. In total, 12,000 individuals. Every single, where we signed off to say that if the CCMA approves the skills layoff application, we'll put in the skills funding required, every single one of them rejected. Why? Because they're coming from atypical employers. Now, atypical employers, contract cleaning industry, contract hiring industry, labor recruitment industry, temporary employment industry. I need to say, sir, specifically the medical sector, where, in fact, the minister issued a directive to provincial governments not to secure nurses and staff from temporary employment agencies, and suddenly thousands of people in this country are out of their jobs. Those companies taking those applications to the CCMA saying, sorry, you're a temporary employment agency, you're a plant hire agency, you're a contract cleaning agency, doesn't qualify for skills layoff. 12,000 people who could still be in jobs, having lost their jobs, full-time contracts, because of those applications coming from temporary employment companies. That's my response to your question, skills layoff. We've not had a single one, and we've submitted the largest number of applications, not we, my sector, to the CCMA for skills layoff funding, not a single one approved. Not a single one approved. That's in response to your question now. Provincial allocation, thank you very much for that question, and you're quite right. It's not horses, it's not one-size-fits-all approach for all provinces. What we're finding is that where we take our targets, some of the targets are more easily achievable in urban areas, whereas they're not in rural areas, and vice versa. So, for example, in the Northern Cape, specifically in Kimberley, we're finding that whole qualification training is not that popular, but skills program training is very, very popular. But, again, the problem there is that we've got very few members. So we're allowing a lot of non-levy-paying member companies to access that training in that province because it's specifically SME-focused. So we balance our target categories depending on which province it is, so that at the end of the day we're meeting all of our targets, even though with different degrees in each province. We are, by the way, cutting some provinces completely out. So, for example, our strategy has been to cut the urban areas out of specific benefit categories to push those categories into the rural areas, and that's proving quite effective as well in that regard. Career guidance, you're quite right. Rural schools have very little access to television and very little access to distance education opportunities, and that's one of the reasons why, number one, we are giving all of our career guidance toolkits directly to the schools rather than broadcast over television. So we're physically giving them the DVDs, physically giving them all of the printed material on all of the careers, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, why in every province we have a career guidance week across 5 days for our 40 different industries. And we bus those people in from those rural areas to those career guidance activities to in fact have exposure. Is it enough? It's never going to be enough. 25,000 schools in the country, there's only so much we can do in that regard. But I do need to say again, Chair, it would certainly help if there were dedicated people in those schools who were responsible for career guidance. That is the biggest weakness in terms of career guidance in this country. No one, no teacher puts their hands up and says, I'll take responsibility for bringing the world of work into my school. And while some of them are allocated, they very often are not the best people for the job. So we're spending a lot of time on developing career guidance teaching, if you want, career guidance exposure facilitation guides and interventions for those schools, the ones that want to play with us. And by the way, I do need to emphasize, Chair, as recently as 18 months ago, schools in particular provinces, and here I'm going to talk about the Eastern Cape in particular, were given the directive not to allow their teachers to attend our career guidance exposure sessions, our cognitive enrichment training. We have cognitive enrichment training and enrichment activities for teachers. That's just in response to your question, though. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done there. Young people. The fact that there are not enough jobs available in this country for young people is no excuse for us to put up our hands and say, well, let's put them in their own companies because we're struggling to find jobs for them. We have an obligation to you and your age group to find you jobs. It's not good enough for me to say, I can't find you a job, so there's money for new venture creation training, go start your own business. 1 out of every 100 people is capable of starting and sustaining their business. It takes a different kind of animal to start and to grow a business. Not everybody's cut out for that. So the first point I want to make in that regard is it's a poor excuse of civil society if my only answer to find you sustainable income is to say, start your own business. You're letting me off the hook by accepting me saying that to you, and even by accepting my money if I was to give you startup capital. That's the first point I wanted to make. Second point I wanted to make is our experience is 96% failure rate under the age of 35, 42% failure rate above the age of 35. The statistics speak for themselves, man. We can show you those statistics.
Ask on that, the new venture in the way it's being implemented in South Africa currently, it is just in terms of the seat responsibility. I'm not speaking about what anyone else needs to do. The new venture, is it so that the seaters will, for example, put training money aside to train person X, and then the actual funding for the business must be given by someone else?
By the banks or by DTI or something like that.
Yes. And then when that lady that wants to start goes to cooler, turns it down because there's no security.
No security.
We know the real issues on the ground for people, right?
Right.
People always say we can, you know, the constituents always say we've got all these fancy things saying we it's these departments you can go to and those agencies, but if they actually go there, then they...
But there's another issue though, Chair.
So it is the support from other sectors, and so I just want to understand this issue, and then also it's also relating to in the public sector space that at times the the government, there was a cabinet decision some years ago, remember Kubayu, when the president, I think then, where there was a decision that 16 or so sectors would be supported at the level of new venture, between the 200,000 and 30 million rand or 1 million and 30 million. And it seems to me that is also not kicking off. So what I'm hearing you are saying from there is, it is therefore not the actual design of the project, because if it is 1 in 100, your stats then tells that even those then that comes in, most of them fail.
Yes.
And it's then because of certain of those things. And
support
the question that he's posing is, do you then close up, or do you actually also correct the system where it is failing? I think that's really...
So, Chair, in response to that question, I think there are two answers. Firstly, everything you said 100% correct, and I won't dwell on the fact that Umsumbombo was a waste of fresh air. I won't dwell on the fact that Kool-Aid never existed except for a couple of choice people, etc., etc. I won't dwell on that. You know that. But what I will acknowledge, though, is the quality of the training provision is not always what it should also be. In other words, yes, we have a learning program. Yes, we have accredited training providers. But it's very difficult to teach entrepreneurialism properly. Entrepreneurship needs to be taught by entrepreneurs. And unfortunately, those who become accredited to teach entrepreneurship are normally the people who work at universities, schools, colleges, the people who can't do so they teach, the old cliche, except for the medical schools, and that's a different issue. So my point, Chair, is absolutely, we know there's a problem with the quality of the teaching and the training, and who does it? We know that completely. And that's another reason for maybe looking back and going a little slow. The second point, though, is this. We're more comfortable in saying to an individual, you want to run a hairdressing salon, first come on our hairdressing learnership, be a hairdresser for a couple of years, and then come back to us for an NVC learnership. We know you, we're more comfortable with you in that particular category than just come straight out of school onto an NVC learnership. It doesn't make logical sense, Chair. So if I can just move off of that point and move to the next questions. Audit committee? Well, I'm only laughing because yesterday was, in fact, the last audit committee meeting of our current cycle. We have 8 audit committee meetings a year. All of those minutes are freely open to the public and accessible to the public. Our audit committee for the last 10 years has been chaired by Mr. Clive Neal, who's a member of the King Commission and has been a member of 1, 2, and 3 in terms of the King Commission. Our internal auditors are KPMG, and they do 6 internal audits a year on different divisions and different activities. We also have a tender ombudsman. So all of our under tender limits as well as tender projects are in fact inspected by neutrally by the tender ombudsman, who's not employed by us but obviously contracted by us, to do 3 tender and quoted contract audits a year on all of our contracts and all of our tenders. And then the Auditor General, who does 3 activities in the CETA every year as well. Can things slip through? Of course things can slip through all of the time. Are we on the guard against it? Absolutely. We are now also being audited in 2 new areas by all of those parties. We're being audited in the area of our IT support infrastructure, which I must tell you is never good, and we're being audited in terms of our performance indicators, including the non-financial performance indicators, and particularly our things like equity and our HR indicators as well. What we've also done for our audit committee, so we have 3 contracted neutral people as auditors on our audit committee, plus we have business and labor representatives on our audit committee, plus what we've now got is we've got 2 newly qualified chartered accountants on internships through KPMG who are being trained up to, in fact, full senior roles eventually on our audit committee as well. So you've got people who are learning the business of CETAs and the PFMA through the process. But again, I say things are never infallible. And really, you are as good as, if you want, the last proven complaint, the last established issue with your organization. From a procurement point of view, very, very difficult. I needn't tell you, in the public sector, from a procurement point of view, I mean, as recently as 2 months ago, the Minister of Labor was complaining to me personally and saying, you know, there's no such thing as preferred providers any longer in terms of the Public Finance Management Act. And so every time we want to procure, even if it's an email distribution, bulk email distribution, we have to go through a 3-quote process, etc. I'm not complaining, but I'm actually talking about timing in terms of not just the procurement, but also the payment cycle of things. It's a very tightly policed process. But I take your question, sir, because your question was really implying, does the bureaucracy sometimes get cover up for the fraud? always a potential for that. Does, in other words, does hiding behind rules and regulations allow things to slip under? Always a possibility, always something we have to safeguard against. Let me get these other two questions. Very quickly. Level of management training, all the way up to NQF 8. I don't like talking about an NQF 10 level. We're, as far as we're concerned, the NQF is 8, not 10 levels. So all the way, talking about an NQF 8, all the way up to chartered management programs. We've signed degrees with the Chartered Management Institute in the UK that all of our programs are aligned to their programs, and people who have our programs all the way up to PhD level are eligible for Chartered Management Institute membership as well, as far as chartered is concerned. If it's a benchmark, you know, it's not a benchmark in South Africa, but it is a benchmark we at least reference against. And as far as the FET is concerned, you give me a directive to spend 80% of my money on FETs, and we will make it work in every way we can. We will bring as many of those 8,000 private training providers into a relationship with the FETs as we can, and there will be very few, but as we can, and we'll make sure that there is a sharing of the spoil so that the funding is not the issue, but in all likelihood, you will see an outsourcing of teaching, almost a privatization of the actual teaching opportunities from those FETs. I tell you that because we've done an audit for 10 of our industries of the 53 FETs out there, and I can let you have a copy of that audit report, and there's currently, at the moment, an audit being done of the readiness of FET colleges by the HSRC on behalf of the National Board for Further Education. We're partly funding that. But there's currently an audit being done of all 53 FETs across all of the CETAs, and I can tell you that the reality is that most of those FETs should be privatized. But if we have to spend the money, we will find a way of doing it, sir.
I'm now noting Member Lachetto's hand. Actually, I want to penalize you, so I'm going to allow Member... I want to allow Member Makabela and Bonamo, and then Member Hadebe.
Chair, thanks, and I'll try and be quick. I had a lot, but I may not be elaborate on those questions. Some will be a bit follow-ups, so you'll just pick them up. The first, just a follow-up on what was raised around the layoff scheme. Generally, not with regard to yours, generally not taking off ground. There are certain things, and the other time we got a report that why companies are not quick on that and the kind of criteria, whether people were retrenched based on the actual recession or what, and so on, a lot more. I don't want to get into that. But the terminology you used at some point in terms of the contract, the temporary contract employment.
Atypical, that industry.
Yes. Now, I wanted to know whether that is the same thing with labor brokers.
Yeah.
You know, so that we don't miss one another, so that we understand it very well. The second is whether your board is functional, you know, because some of the things from a distance, you don't get a sense whether there's a board that directs what is actually going on and so on. You talked the targets on the slides 11 and 12. Whether those targets are basically benchmarked on something, or they just usually people will come up with targets that are easy to obtain and come back to say, no, we achieved 100%, we have outdone ourselves, you know, our expectations were like this and that.
So we set low targets.
Generally, people do that. Or you get a sense that something like that happens, you know. People not being genuine in terms of what happens, because if you don't understand what previously was like,
yes,
and what were the costs involved, and why now the target could be at this level, you can't make sense of why the target today will be 4.5 people, or, you know. So I just wanted to, even if it's not today, sir, some of the things, but we may need answers to those, even in writing, to saying this is what is actually happening. When we talk public institutions that can as well be service providers, so FETs and so on, we're looking at them not coming in as junior participants, that generally they can either be sidelined or left. Our understanding will be that they are service providers in their own right, like universities and so on, they are giving services by now. Now, you want to bring them onto the main stream of providing such training services. Now, when they come in, there must be a sense of them being full participant and having some weight in the whole scheme of things so that they do their part. Because you may want as government to do a lot more training through them as well, and not them somewhat being told by somebody who's a big brother to say, no, you can't do this, you can, perhaps your accreditation of these modules and so on and so on may not be right and so on, will prepare this, and therefore redirecting the money and so on. We have got trust in those public institutions, so they can. No, you may look at them either having failed or whatever, but we have got trust in the institutions that we have created as government. We have got our own standards in there. So if in a particular program we believe they can actually train, there's no much sense why we should go private and not necessarily go through the public institutions. Just the tender processes that you're holding and the BEE thing, yes, there's controversy in there. But in your own field, to what extent is this not a window dressing? You know, genuinely implementing BEE, not in terms of training, even in terms of them rendering services, training and so on and so on, not believing that they still need to be capacitated, and therefore some institutions being so credible in your own regard that they will only capacitate these co-ops and other BEs and so on, but with them, if they can give training, are there any such examples wherein you've got BE companies that themselves conduct training and you have actually, just as I want to conclude two things here. One, the customer satisfactory level. How do you test them? You refer to you testing those, and because you can say you are at 60%, but how you arrived at that may be a bit of an issue. This metric people that you retrain, you said 3,000 have been taken back into metric repeating, and I still don't have much clarity. So you said they're in public schools, mostly in rural areas. But at the, and you're introducing them into all these metrics, they're repeating their metric.
So you're talking about the school feeder project?
Yes.
The second chance.
Yeah. And you said they emerge from there with better metric.
I don't know. It's a
different
one.
Two
separate programs.
Okay, the others just go back to metric repeating,
yes.
And they don't emerge from there with this occupation.
No.
Okay, so they write the same exam with
yes.
The rest normally. Oh, okay. The discretionary plans, how do you pick on them? The adults, the non-levy payers, and who is the other category?
How do you select them?
Yes, how do you select them yourself? Who's involved in there to say in this particular province or this particular category, these can be the 4,500 or whoever who come in. In terms of young people, you referred to the youth development agency that are involved, is fine. But beyond them, who else is actually involved in there? And the very last federal development strategy, they're saying they've got difficulty. You don't agree necessarily with certain things. I wonder if you will have time to elaborate here and now, but I thought we needed to understand if there's a difficult thing when in terms of government it's part of our priorities and we want to see it successful. I think if there are particular views that don't agree with the whole thing and they must be involved in assisting us to deal with that, I think it must be an issue for concern. So either now or beyond, we may need a very elaborate answer to that question.
Yeah. Thank you. Can we have Member Panam?
Thank you, Chairperson. You've disadvantaged me by ignoring me, so many of my questions have been taken by others.
I think.
However.
No, it's not true because I've ignored the person on my right hand side. He was supposed to speak actually before you.
Thank you. Chairperson, there is a tendency by CEOs of CITES every time they come to appear before the committee, they come and, you know, defend their CITES and only tell us the good things about them and actually not telling us what the challenges are. And I think it is important for us as a committee to also know where problems are, so that if we can assist, we should do so. We don't only want to be told beautiful things. If you look at what is happening, the reality is the opposite of what we are being told. Now, slide number 5, speeding up economic growth and transforming the economy to create decent work and sustainable livelihood. The question is, what is your target on this? And within what time frame do you intend to have actually achieved your intentions? Slide number 8.
That was slide number 5, the last one.
And I'm now on slide number 8. I'm done with slide number 5. Scarce and critical skills. Can you unpack those scarce skills and also say what is it that you are doing to try and address them, and what time frame have you given yourself to have completely addressed these scarce and critical skills, because they are actually a serious problem in our country. You also said that business support should be given to matured people who have work experience and lost jobs and banks can't loan them some money, rather than giving young people who have just dropped out from schools or universities some businesses which are not going to be sustainable and money goes down the drain. And I agree with you totally on that, because, you know, if you give matured people businesses, because of their age, maturity, and experience, they are going to be able to sustain these businesses and then employ the young and inexperienced, who will then gain experience and later on can establish their own businesses. The other question is, of the total number of youth who have dropped out of schools and universities in this country, including those who have completed their studies but could not get jobs, how many have you assisted to get decent work and or training? And what percentage is this? Do you have any intentions to restructure the learnerships? Because people do go through these learnerships, but ultimately they don't get employment. They roam the streets again, and money has been spent on them. Thank you.
Just very direct response. Right, Chair, and please forgive me if I talk too quickly. I will slow down if you need me to. So let's start. Training layoff. My deputy CEO is dying to say something in that regard. Deb?
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to say we had a meeting with the National Commissioner of the CCMA quite recently, etc., approaching CITES, because, as you know, that $2.4 billion fund, just about $30 million has been tapped into.
Only $30 million of the $2.4 billion has been spent.
And it's sitting out there. So the challenges are really the following. It's very prescriptive in its requirements, and the dynamics of the participants are really an economic one. So retrenched people want their package, and they want training. They want both. The layoff scheme does not offer both. It offers an alternative. Employers want to build this element of trust in terms of how they engage with the CCMA, that still needs to be built and developed. There's a lot of areas there for developmental work. So in essence, you have employers that are shying away. Those that have participated have been told, the tick box, you missed one tick, you can't participate. The challenge really going forward is, what do we do with the retrenched people? And I think, Chair, where the scheme and the discussions are positive on the layoff scheme, is that can the scheme address the needs of those that have been retrenched, whether they took the package or not? How can we repatriate them, use their talents, etc., as part of our labor force? And as a CETA, we're looking to engage, and we're now sending employers directly to the CCMA there. Otherwise, Chair, we'd be sitting in the same room next year, and that fund would not have gone beyond $2 billion. And that's an optimistic view of how the prescriptions and the fund is. So I think as a committee and as stakeholders in this process of utilizing that fund, it's going to become a white elephant as a fund. And it's just a concern I wanted to lay on the training layoff scheme as a comment as well as a concern. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Deb. I think an important factor of what Devon's just mentioned, sir, is the notion that trade unions are not getting a mandate, sign-off, from their members in those companies to approach the CCMA and the training layoff scheme, because if they agree to participate in the training layoff scheme, they have to forego their retrenchment packages. That's one of the biggest problems. So if I'm going to give you permission to put me on a training layoff program, I lose my package. And that's part of the problem there in that regard. Right. Is our board functional? Well, we have 250 board members across 15 different governance structures in the services CETA, because we cover 37 industries. 250 board members across 37 different industries in 15 different governing structures, equally balanced.
Or is it, just a question, it's the different sectors. Industries in the sector,
yes,
then have their small kind of...
Yes.
Okay.
So on average, we have between an 8 and a 12 person,
okay,
chamber board for different industries in our 37 industries. Then the chair and the vice chair of those structures, business and labor, then form collectively our national council structure. At the moment, we're chaired by CASATU. We're actually chaired by our labor movement in this cycle, and each cycle it swaps between business and labor in terms of how the CETA is chaired. Our stakeholders are very actively involved in the services CETA. The average tenure of our stakeholders is between 5 and 7 years in the services CETA, and that's part of the success of why our boards are so functional, is there's institutional knowledge in and amongst those board members. They participate in different committees year on year, so they'll move from 1 year, they'll move from ETQA to finance, et cetera, and so their generic capacity is developed. So that we can actually have them RPLs, and we've started doing this against the management qualifications. And we've started doing this, as I'm saying. So I believe that our boards are very functional in the service CETA, and there's equal participation from organized business and organized labor. Is there sufficient representation? No. I'll give you a practical example. Less than 30% of businesses that pay the skills levy are represented by the organized business structures in the services CETA, and that's, on average, good. It's actually better than most other CETAs. From a labor point of view, maybe it's just because of the services sector, less than 1% of employees on whose behalf the skills levy is paid in the service sector are actually represented by trade unions. So the rest are represented by professional bodies, by other individual collective associations. So there's a lot of work that continues. But then remember, when we started, there were no bargaining councils in our CETA. When we started, there was no culture of engagement either. So it certainly is a growth opportunity there. As far as your slides 11 and 12 are concerned, how do we develop our targets? Well, we develop them year on year, and we develop them together with the, that's my boss over there, in the Department of Higher Education and Training, and so they look at our income relative to each of the targets from NSDS3, and so we say, for example, we can do 100 in a particular category. They say, sorry about that, you're going to do 1,000, and we end up settling on about 700. That's how we started. And then year on year, we measure ourselves against accomplishment. If this year, instead of my target of 700, I do 7,000, my target next year is then 8,000. And that's, in fact, how those targets are built up. I think what you're implying, though, is a good thing. Maybe we should go back from 2000 and look at how our targets have increased in each category as opposed to actual accomplishments. That could be a very good research exercise amongst all CETAs. We'd be certainly happy to be measured against that. But it is about institutional knowledge, so I agree with you completely. Well, all I can do is I can disagree with you. You say we've got trust in public institutions. I'm saying that particularly at the FET band, we do not have trust in public institutions based on our experience in the services sector. You say that we should favor public institutions. I'm saying that would be foolhardy, given that we accredit 8,000 training providers and the public institutions have not wanted to become accredited by us. But I think that the truth of the agreement will be somewhere in the middle between your desk and my desk at the end of the day. As far as BE is concerned, is it window dressing of providers? Our largest programs, I'm talking about thousands of learnerships, our largest programs are handled by black training providing businesses, not white. So the largest proportion of allocation of bursaries and learnerships in the services sector, and it's different industry to industry, but I'm generalizing, are by organizations which don't just have a BEE rating, but are 100% black owned and controlled within the services sector. And we're happy to parade them in this room and let you speak to them and see if they're happy with your notion, sir, that they're window dressing and that behind the scenes, there are a whole group of people who are actually doing the training who are not part of the PDI group. Because I think they might take offense to your typification of how they do business. But that's just my observation of what you said about window dressing. Is there window dressing? Of course there's window dressing. There's always going to be window dressing. We guard against it. We guard against it also, by the way, that over the last 2 years, we've actually paid for accredited training providers to get BEE rating from rating organizations. We actually created a grant for that purpose, including SME exemptions. And the SME exempt guys, we didn't let off the hook. We said if you wanted to do business with us, you had to subscribe to a minimum of 4 of the 7 pillars of empowerment. So we're forcing them into that role and into that model, sir. Customer satisfaction. Well, we do what the corporate sector does. We measure it. We put out to tender customer satisfaction rating, customer satisfaction index, and ratings of the services CETA, and we take what we get, and sometimes it's good, and very often it's bad, but we live with it. We learn from what our customers say is bad about our service, and we try and improve. So, for example, you put your BMW in for service, and you get a phone call from Synovate in the call center industry about the quality of customer service. By the way, we happen to put the learners into Synovate to phone you, but that's a different issue. We do exactly the same. We contract with companies like Synovate, marketing research companies, who happen to also be our members, by the way. Maybe that's why they keep giving us such bad ratings. And they do customer satisfaction of our activities of each of our departments. And some of them are very low. And we then say, right, that's the baseline. Now, the next time we do it, we try to have a better rating. And that's, we've been doing that for 10 years. So. Well, no, we actually skipped 2 years. And we got to one stage where the rating was so bad, we said, right, let's just skip a couple of years until we know we've improved and then start measuring the service again. But that was 4 years ago. You never like that kind of information about yourself. You have to have a good, you know, good strong ego. Second Chance Project. The National Youth Development Agency asked CETAs to fund the Second Chance Project. That's these people who fail matric or get a bad matric and need to go back. And so we put those 3,000 bursaries. The value of each bursary is not a lot of money. It's 4,000 Rand per person. We put that into the marketplace for the National Youth Development Agency as part of their Second Chance program. That's not our school program. Our school program is taking our normal learnerships and feeding it into grade 10, 11, and 12 over a three-year period. That's a different model, sir. Our discretionary plans, how do we select our discretionary targets? Well, it's directed by the National Skill Development Strategy, and then in our service level agreements with the Department of Higher Education and Training, we agree on those discretionary plans. And then we say to our member companies, apply, and we never say to a company, no. If, for example, let's say, for example, there are 100 bursaries available in a particular category, and 100 companies apply, then the reality is each company will get one allocation. Each qualifying company will get one allocation. So we don't turn companies away and then give other companies. What we try and do is make sure that we can spread the benefit. And look, I mean, this game is very much like the old industry training board before CETAs were around. You know, 1,000 companies pay their levies, but only 100 use the levies. And that's how this game, the balance of income in the CETA is, in fact, predicated. Right, moving on. Rural development strategy. Very shortly, why it doesn't work. We do a lot of rural development work, and that's why I can talk from experience. In other words, we put a lot of our bursaries, our internships, our learnerships into the rural areas. First problem is you can't really put learnerships into a rural area where there are no businesses. Because the principle of a learnership is someone must be able to go into learnership to get work experience. Huge problem. Second problem, where we do put our bursaries into the rural areas, we find we cause major urbanization. A guy gets a qualification. He doesn't want to stay in a rural area. He wants to go into the urban area now to find a job. So we're the cause of some of the urbanization going on in this country through our rural initiatives. And the problem there is that the Department of Trade and Industry specifically, but also now the Department of Economic Development and Planning, needs to focus, they've not done this in the past, needs to focus on effective rural business node development. Without it, anything we do is a waste of time and in fact is counterproductive because it causes urbanization. In other words, they need to create the businesses and create the business incentive opportunities for businesses to be created in rural areas that can then absorb the learners that we're training. Because at the moment we're training the guys, they want to find work because now they're qualified, so they go into the urban areas. So we think there's a huge focus there that needs to be given on rural development strategies. Okay. Where are the problems in CETAs? Well, there's a problem with public perception, sir. The problem, first and foremost, is that politicians on all sides of the table at different stages love nothing better than CETA bashing for their own vested interests, and I'm including all parties here. So at times the opposition will talk CETAs into the ground and say they should be scrapped, and everyone believes what they're saying. Why? Because CETAs were not their idea in the first place. But at other times, our own principals would talk us into the ground. Well, there's a whole lot of reasons, but at other times our own principles will talk us into the ground. Why? Because it's sometimes politically opportune to do that, because that's where public sentiment sometimes goes. So we are the flotsam and the jetsam in the wind very often as a CETA, and our own members sometimes lose faith in us because of what they read in the papers and what people say about us. That's a huge problem. Mark Wade, one in particular. Right. We are the meat in that sandwich. Let's not get to names. Another huge problem with CETA, sir, is this. Either consciously or unconsciously, people do not understand financial reports. So there is this assumption that CETAs have billions of rands of unspent money sitting in bank accounts. And yet, I don't know how many, but about 18 of the existing number of CETAs have had clean, audited general reports on how we spend and use our money for the last 10 years. We are the strongest financially secure group of public organizations in this country, and yet there is this perception created, sometimes consciously, that CETAs have unspent billions of rand sitting in the bank. Okay, I don't need numbers, though. Of billions of rand sitting in the bank. Because people do not understand or want to understand the difference between a million rand sitting in a bank account, which is part of a contract, a commitment, that then just needs to be paid out against the milestones, as opposed to a million rand sitting in the bank account, which is unallocated. CETAs generally do not have more than 4 months of unallocated money sitting in their bank accounts. Why 4 months? Because the Public Finance Management Act says, God forbid the Department of Higher Education fails to pay the money over 2 or 3 months, you've got to have operating capital. So outside of 4 months of operating capital sitting in our bank accounts, I guarantee you that the majority of CETAs out there spend their money. But spending the money means this. I give you a contract for a million rand. I'm not going to give you a million rand up front. I'm going to give you 100,000 rand on signing the contract. And then we're going to agree to milestones against which the payments are going to be made to you. And the last 100,000 rand, I'm only going to pay out to you when I actually see that certificate of competency for that learner, which sometimes can be 18 months. So the money, the moment I sign the contract, the money goes into a trust account. But our Public Finance Management Act doesn't allow me to call it a trust account. So our Public Finance Management Act says that if it's in the bank, it's a surplus, even though it's committed on the contract. So I'm happy. We will fund financial education for politicians in this country, every single politician to understand this concept, because it's a perennial problem. I guarantee you something. I guarantee you something. I will give you, I'll put 1,000 rand on the table now, sir, that when we produce this year's annual report, as long as you're prepared to meet me with $1,000. So when we put this annual report before you and it goes into the media, I guarantee you that a party which shall remain nameless, okay, is going to go to the newspaper and say, scratch CETAs because they've got billions of rands of unspent money in the bank. even though every single year we have the same discussion with them, we educate them, and they acknowledge what we've educated them, next year they say exactly the same thing. Why? Because it's a sound bite. It gives you an opportunity to be noticed by the public. So anyway, but I'm not going to go on about that. I know, Chair, time is running out. Let me just finish my answer.
And we are speaking here about seats that are not NSF.
I'm not talking about the 6 billion rand sitting in the National Skills Fund that hasn't been released for 4 years.
Surplus and underspending.
No.
We've got a
about the 6 billion rand sitting in the National Skills Fund, sir.
Okay, but I'm just saying...
Where we had an application before them for 36 months.
Just the anger.
Sorry.
I really want to start concluding, and I think your response is a bit long, CEO.
I'll just get point form on the rest.
Just the last... Just on 1 minute on responding on that question.
All right.
And then I'm going to hand over to the last
question. Well, Chair, there were like 4 other questions.
Yes. 1 minute.
Okay, sorry, Chair. All right. Just very quickly, one of our biggest problems is the level of transformation and measurement of transformation in our industry. We're going to spend the next 5 years dealing with measuring transformation and causing transformation, even though it might be politically inappropriate to do that. Scarce skills, we've got a full scarce skills list. We upgrade it every year. Our members tell us what's in scarce supply. Oh, sorry, Chair, I have to mention this. One of the issues of NSDS 3 I didn't mention, that has to be mentioned. We have millions of unemployed people in this country. You've got no way, sir, of telling me who of them can do what job. And yet NSDS 3 is legitimating. It actually says they create a policy for the importation of scarce skills into this country from other countries. I don't know if you're aware of that. It's legitimating the importation of scarce skills from other countries into South Africa when we're sitting with millions of unemployed people, many of whom are economically active or potentially active, but we can't find them. We don't know what skills they've got. That is an aberration. But anyway, let's move on to it. Business support, well, I completely agree with you. That was a statement. Of the total number of youth who've dropped out or not employed, how many get jobs? We blackmail business to actually employ these guys once they finish their learnership. So we actually blackmail them. We actually pay them something called a gainful employment grant. So we say, if you keep the person on for a year after they finish the learnership, we will give you X amount per month of what it's going to cost you to employ them now that you're not getting any other grant. You're not getting a learnership grant or a bursary. In fact, that has been such a successful strategy of our CETA. We're the only CETA to have been doing that for the last 10 years. But it's such a successful strategy that it's now incorporated into NSDS 3. The only problem being, Chair, that we're told in NSDS 3 we shouldn't pay that grant to the employer any longer to compensate his employment expenses. We should pay it to the public provider as a reward for doing their job. And we take huge issue with that. Why should the provider get it for doing what they paid to do in the first place? But that's a different issue for a different day. We have 80% gainful employment success of 6 months or longer after the learnership has been completed on our actual statistics. So, and there's my learnership manager to give you the numbers if you need the managers. 80% on average. We did a chairman's project, which in fact was launched by the president last year in November, where we certificated individuals who after the learnership had been in gainful employment for more than 80% of those learners. So we're very proud of our gainful employment, converting the learnership to the work opportunity. 80, sir.
I'm the last two people. Well, I really appreciate the presentation that you've just received. I just want to get a clarity here, Chair, that in relation to the outcry that is mentioned here in terms of the NSDS 3, that it is valid in terms of the skills development facilitators. And in terms of the issues of people with disabilities, I'm trying to check what does the CETA has in place. Is it going to be able to cater in such? Is it going to be able to try and address or mitigate such kind of challenge? As it has noticed that there's a gap there and there. The other question is that I'm trying to check, man. Maybe it's because of the area that I'm coming from, that is one of the disadvantaged areas. I'm from the province that doesn't have a university, and you know that is struggling in terms of this skills development.
I really request that the solicitor must help me in this one to address, because I'm telling you, we are really, you know, the issue of skills is a very serious challenge. And you must remember, Mpumalanga, that's the hub of coal that provides coal. It's an area that provides agriculture. It's an area that knows got a lot of opportunities that are there that, you know, can provide the country and the economy of the country to be up. That's why I need the, you know, the service system. I need to see it, you know, physically there that, you know, it's being implemented, this program, because I haven't been seeing it. I've also noticed that during the weekend, you know, you end in the Northern Cape, one of the provinces that doesn't have a university, then you came successfully there in terms of the implementation. But I really need you to assist me in terms of this. I really noticed that you've had sort of an MOU with the NYDA in terms of the 3,000 assistance project that you're going to implement. But if you can be able to respond into this specific one in terms of addressing, because I'm telling you, Mpumalanga is one of the disadvantaged areas. It's really not being noticed in most cases.
Point made.
I'm not generalizing. But the last question is, I'm being harassed here.
Okay, the last issue.
The last issue, Che, is that I really need to check in terms of your strategy, in terms of the youth employment strategy. That's how long is it going to be effective? Because we want to ensure that within short space of time, we see the realization of this project. Because, you know, strategies are always placed there, but they're not be able to be implemented within a certain specific period of time. Thanks.
Thank you. The second last person.
Chairperson Manus Short. Mine is on the occupational qualification. How long has this particular program been running? Mm-hmm. Is it in all provinces?
For the school, that's right.
Yeah. And numbers of students that have gone through this. And can you track these students to say exactly if they have X amount, those X amount are all now employed, and where are they employed? I think we're all aware that the rural areas are a problem. It's a challenge to us. And I would like to see, hear what you saying now that you're part of, you know, the creating these people once they have qualified to move out of the rural areas. What is Service Theatre doing to assist the issue within the rural areas?